Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS recognized specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Ben Walton. Thank you, Ben. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Ema, for the introduction. Thank you everyone for joining me for this webinar. This is the second part of a two-part webinar on articular fractures in dogs and cats. The first part was done last year and concentrated on common articular fractures of the thoracic limb. And today we'll be looking at common articular fractures of the pelvic limb. So these first few slides are shared with that that first part of this this two-part seminar, really just to remind ourselves of what we are trying to achieve when we are managing articular fractures in dogs and cats. And this is really sort of a hierarchy of outcomes that we're gunning for. So obviously, in an ideal world, we would be able to achieve and maintain normal joint function. If we can't achieve that, we should be looking at our best chance of achieving pain-free function, and if we can't achieve that, we should be looking at our best chance of giving the patient at least the best quality of life that we can get for it. And the ways we do that are by adhering to the principles of articular fracture treatment. So again, these are a reminder which you'll be well familiar with. What we're really hoping for here is this third point is immediate mobilization. We want to get these joints moving early in a relatively normal way. And the way we achieve that is through a combination of the three other points, points one, two, and four there. Accurate anatomic reduction with stable internal fixation and as atraumatic approach as we can possibly achieve. Articular fractures carry with them some specific challenges beyond those of non-articular fractures, not least in the diagnosis. As you'll see in some of the cases that we'll go through in this webinar, it's not always easy to determine whether a fracture affects a joint surface or not. And we'll look at how the different imaging modalities we have available can be useful in this. Arthrocentesis can play a part if you're suspicious of an articular fracture but aren't sure, particularly if it's an acute case, as you will often have blood cells in the joint fluid, and if it's a chronic case, there might even be osteocytes present as well. So arthrocentesis can be useful if you don't have access to advanced imaging. Obviously, there are the issues then around the fact that we're often dealing with very small pieces of bone in regions where there are lots of tendons and ligaments and joint capsule, etc. So the anatomy that is invariably involved in articular fractures gives us issues with surgical access, places to position the implants, the size of the implant that we can get in, and therefore the strength. Like I say, we're aiming for as early a function as possible. So our option for treatment, just coming back to that hierarchy of goals that we covered a couple of slides ago, our options for treatment to achieve these things might be primary reduction and fixation. Sometimes intra-articular fragments are so small that they're not amenable to fixation, and we might just need to remove them if they're impinging in any way. Conservative treatment rarely plays a part as the primary means of treatment of articular fractures. It clearly plays a part in post-operative care. And there is always going to be a balance between supporting the region to enhance the chances of healing with external coaptation, but mobilizing the joint as soon as we can so that we don't get periarticular disease and end up with poor joint function in the face of good bone healing. And there are certainly numerous cases and scenarios where primary reduction fixation might not be appropriate, and we'll be looking at one of these salvage procedures, excision arthroplasty, arthrodesis, or total joint replacement. And again, examples of these salvage procedures will be covered in the course of this webinar. So, we're going to start at the top of the pelvic limb and work our way down, covering the hip, the stifle, and the tarsus. So with the hip then, we're going to spend a bit of time discussing acetabular fractures before we move on to femoral head fractures. Excuse me one second. So the acetabula are involved in approximately one third of pelvic fractures. So just to illustrate that point, we'll take this results table from this paper here from about 8 or 9 years ago from the Glasgow group that looked at the role of CT in the classification and management of pelvic fractures. And we can see there that across dogs and cats, around about 32% of cases in this series involve the acetabula. And they define those further as well. Here's a little histogram of the fracture configurations that were seen in that study. And we can see here in column 1, column 5 and 6, and this last column here, we've got acetabular fractures on their own or in combination with various other fractures as well. So a relatively frequent site for pelvic fractures to occur. In terms of options for repair, there are a number of options. There are these in the middle here. Hopefully you can see my cursor. In the middle here, we have the bespoke acetabular plates, which have been around for a good few years. And they are sort of shaped in this sort of semi-lunar shape to fit over the top of the acetabulum. And we've got a radiograph of a case here that was managed with one of those cases. Then we have a variety of bone plates that can be contoured around all three geometric axes, from the non-locking reconstruction plates over here on the left. And what we have here illustrating locking plates that are contourable around the three geometric axes is the OrthoMed SOP plate. You could also include in there the EvoLox plate, and Iscalap now also do a similar design plate that can be contoured. And these locking plates can be very useful for fractures in this region. Illustrated in this paper here, this case report from Neil Burton in JFMS a few years ago, this is another option for acetabular fracture repair, whereby you place screws in the fragments of bone and draw the fragments together with these interfragmentary wires placed around the screw heads to compress the fracture. And then you embed these wires and the screw heads in polymethylmethacrylate cement, bone cement, to create this sort of construct. And I've used this two or three times in pelvic fracture repairs. It's quite nice. It gives you the flexibility of having the screws purchasing the fragments to bring the fracture together in compression. And it's not until you're really happy with the reduction and the alignment before you apply that cement. And it's quite a flexible way of doing things. It can end up being quite bulky though, and that's something that you need to be cognizant of when you're doing that. The approach is invariably via a dorsal approach to the hip. It is almost impossible to do this meaningfully through a craniodorsal approach whereby you preserve the gluteal insertions. What you'll end up doing is just gradually stretching and destroying the gluteal tendons. So much better to approach these from the outset as a classic dorsal approach to the hip. So for dogs, for me, that always includes a greater trochanteric osteotomy, as illustrated here in this still from Pia Marti's approaches to dogs and cats. In cats, some prefer a gluteal tenotomy. And actually, the strength of the tendon repair and the healing in cats is often pretty good. That's an option for cats. But for dogs, at least, I would always consider the osteotomy to be my preferred choice. But you need this to get the decent access to an acetabular fracture. One of the most challenging aspects of acetabular fracture repair is undoubtedly implant purchase in the caudal fragment. That is always the really difficult point because access there is challenging. You've got the sciatic nerve coming down the back here, which you need to watch out for. And what you might also need to elevate or transect is this tendon here of the external obturator muscle, which is in, it has a very tight, firm attachment in the intertrochanteric notch on the caudal aspect of the femoral neck there. And that can really sort of get in the way. It's not a tendon that you can stretch or retract easily. You might need to resect that. Bear with me one second. So we'll consider now over the next few slides, sort of going back a stage really from repair to diagnosis. And what our options are for diagnosing pelvic fractures. And we'll look at all of these radiographs in a bit more detail over the next few slides. The left and the middle radiograph are from the same case, and the radiograph on the right is from a separate case. So coming back to this paper then by Davina Drafan from the Glasgow group, what they attempted to do in this paper was to ask various orthopedic surgeons to classify pelvic fractures based on radiographic views and based on computed tomography, and furthermore ask them to prognosticate for each fracture. So what we're essentially trying to discover here is whether CT gives you any meaningful information that might influence the advice that you give to an owner or the treatment protocol that you follow. And to cut a fairly long story short, the conclusion, or the tentative conclusion, I should say, of that paper was that CT was most useful over and above radiography for pelvic fractures in the cases of fractures that involve the sacrum and the acetabuli. So it you know it's essentially it gives you extra information and will pick up can potentially pick up acetabular fractures that a radiograph can't. From personal experience, the other information that I would say that the CT gives you over and above radiography, even if you have already diagnosed an acetabular fracture on radiography, is the degree of comminution of the fracture and how likely you are to be able to satisfactorily reconstruct that in surgery. Because not every pelvic fracture is reconstructable. A particular point of note is damage to the medial wall of the acetabulum. And if there is severe and extensive damage to that medial wall, even if you can get the dorsal sort of column reconstructed and stabilized, the animal is at risk of protrusio acetabuli, which is where the femoral head displaces medially through the pelvis and into the pelvic canal. So it's something to be aware of, and CT very useful in that regard. Bear with me one second. So let's look at a case or two here. So we have here the radiographs of a dog, a little terrier crossbreed dog with multiple pelvic fractures. And I want you just to take a little bit of time to look at this, these radiographs, and try and decide for yourself whether the acetabula to the right of the image here is involved in the fracture or not. So give you a moment to look at those two views. Okay, and then I'm going to move on. And what I'm going to show you now is some stills from a 3D reconstruction of the surface topography of that scan. So what we can see over here is the acetabulum from a dorsal perspective. And on this view, it certainly doesn't look as though the acetabulum is affected. We've got a fracture in the body of the ilium. We've got a fracture in the ischium here. And it looks like that bit is tipped, but the acetabulum looks spared. If we look at that sort of laterally and ventrally, Again, a similar story. We can see that the acetabulum is intact, obviously got the femoral neck in the way there, but it looks as though that this fracture line is really just glancing, if at all, that the caudal aspect of the acetabulum. And on this view, which looks at it caudally, we can see that the acetabulum itself is intact all the way around. And what we have here is a fracture of the ischium. And let me just go back a couple of slides. If we go back with that knowledge and we look at these views, the things that we can do are to trace the joint space here around both the femoral heads and say, well, actually, you know, you've got a nice, clear, parallel joint space all the way around both of these. And when we look at the VD view over here, what we appreciate now is that this acetabular fragment of bone is fractured in all three bones around the acetabulum, ilium, ischium, pubis, and that segment has just rotated. So what we're getting here is like a skyline view. But you know, it's a brave and confident radiologist that calls that as definitely non-articular based on those radiographs. And once that fracture is reduced and stabilized with a bone plate, thus we can see pretty confidently actually that the acetabulum isn't involved in that fracture. That's just the case to illustrate some of the value of CT. So here's another case that we'll have a look at. You've already seen this radiograph briefly. So again, I'm going to give you just a few moments there to have a little look at that and try and make up your mind whether the acetabulum is involved in this case. All right, so as you know, it's never fair just to give you one view. You're never going to make a conclusion from a single view. You need your orthogonal projections. And if we have a look at the lateral view, that kind of gives us our answer in this case. So we can see that the fracture does involve the acetabulum. Again, if we look at this, so this is a slightly oblique view. This isn't a straight lateral. This is how I like my oblique views when assessing the acetabulum. I don't like them too oblique. I like to be looking at as lateral a radiograph as I can. So literally just tilt them just enough to get one hip out the way of the other. So this is done with the cat in lateral recumbency. And what we can see here is if we look at the lower of the two hip joints, again, we follow that joint space. We can see that nice and clear there. But what we can see here, if we follow the joint space on this femoral head, it essentially disappears here. Okay, it widens out at that point, then disappears sort of mid-caudal. And then off the fracture line goes there. So this is an acetabular fracture. So that's a bit on imaging. And now we're going to move on to decision making. So there is a perception, I believe, that the position of the fracture within the acetabulum has a bearing on whether or not you should attempt repair or recommend repair. So let's just explore that a little bit now. And you know, what I'm demonstrating with this radiograph here is, you know, just a very, very caudal acetabular fracture. So the advice is often that if the fracture involves the caudal third of the acetabulum, that surgical management is not indicated. Bear with me. So from a biomechanical perspective, this was investigated in two very nice papers by Alison Beck around about 10, 15 years ago. And both these papers were published in the Journal of Biomechanics. So the first of these was looking at the regional load bearing of the feline acetabulum. So the study was done by taking cadaveric samples of cats in a load bearing model, whereby the hip joint was compressed after being injected with cement so that the cement would extrude, and where the cement was thinnest or absent, that's where weight bearing was occurring, and where there was thicker layers of cement residual, then that obviously meant that those areas were not load bearing. And if we move forward to the images, this is just a cadaveric sample, just illustrating how they define the segments. And this is a sample from one of the results that was performed. And what we can see here that up in the cranial third and down here in the acetabular fossa, we've got this nice thick preserved layer of cement. And it's actually centrally and caudally that we can see that the cement has been extruded. So in cats, in this cadaveric model at least, it appears that the caudal part of the acetabulum is very, very important in load bearing. The same experiment was repeated in dogs. Alison Beck was Alison Moores by this stage, but the same person. And this again is a sample of one of the specimens, and we can see that the cement has been extruded around the full surface of the acetabulum. Cement is preserved in the acetabular fossa, as you would expect, but over here on the caudal aspect, the cement has been extruded again, suggesting that that is a load-bearing area of the acetabulum. Now, what does that mean clinically? Well, Budrio, 30 years ago, reported on clinical outcomes of 15 cases of caudal third acetabulum fractures that were managed conservatively. The results were generally unsatisfactory. 13 of the 15 cases developed moderate to severe OA, 12 had pain or decreased range of motion, and almost half the cases were actually visibly lame. So this really sort of concurs with the fact that this probably is a load-bearing area, and further consideration should be given to whether these fractures are stabilized or not. For me, I think an important issue here, and what I'm not saying here, is that every caudal third acetabular fracture should necessarily be fixed, but we certainly need to be careful in terms of how we counsel and advise our owners and manage their expectations. For me personally, I think one of the factors that might steer you towards managing these conservatively is just that the technical challenge of stabilizing caudal third acetabulum fractures. They can be very, very challenging. A cranial third fracture, there is more bone stock, the access is easier. And I can generally confidently say that providing that the medial wall is intact, there's a good chance that you'll get good reduction and good stabilization. These caudal third fractures, I think, are technically more challenging. And again, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't operate, but it's just worth being aware of all these things, A, for your own sake before you go into surgery, but B, so you can have a meaningful and accurate discussion with the owners about their expectations beforehand. Of course, we have some salvage options available to us, and one of those is always excision arthroplasty, which could be done at the time of injury, if we don't want to give these dogs a chance or cats a chance with conservative management, or you can it could be done further down the line if the clinical outcome is unsatisfactory. So this study was a retrospective study done on a whole load of dogs and cats in Germany back in the mid-90s or something like that, and it was republished in VCOT a few years ago in English language. It was first published in German language. In summary, in cats, for example, of those managed with excision arthroplasty, there's all sorts of things going on in the long term with these cats. The limb is rarely in a normal position. There is very often significant muscle atrophy, virtually always restricted range of motion, and occasionally pain. But 100% of the owners in this study were satisfied with the outcome in cats. So, it's always there. The excision arthroplasty is always there as an option in the back of our mind for these cases. So that's the discussion on acetabular fractures. Let me just get a drink here, bear with me. Okay, and we're going to move on now to femoral head neck fractures. Now, these are more, generally speaking, and what I want to concentrate on here today is primarily these fractures in cats. We'll discuss a canine case in this section as well. These are generally speaking not articular fractures in the fact that the articulating surface is usually preserved. These are more intra-articular fractures. But I did want to spend just a few moments discussing these fractures because I think it's worth thinking about how these are managed in cats in particular. And you'll see what I mean as the discussion unfolds. So this is Roman, who actually was involved in some trauma, and he has a fracture of his femoral head, or his femoral capitis, which you can just about see there, but is more obvious in this case on the extended hip view. This isn't always the case, actually. Sometimes these fractures kind of compress themselves and tighten up when you do this extended hip view, and they can be difficult to see, and you see them better on the frog-legged view. So if you're ever suspicious of femoral head or neck fractures, make sure that you get those radiographs in both the extended hip and the frog leg view. But you can see very clearly our femoral head fracture here. And these are our options for management of these fractures. We can repair them, we can perform our femoral head and neck ostectomy, or we can do a total hip replacement. So, as I said, Roman was actually a trauma case, but we'll very often see, very often might be a strong word or a strong term for this, we will often see femoral head fractures, these femoral capitis fractures in cats with minimal to no trauma. And it's worth just spending a little bit of time just looking at the pathology of these fractures. So, just as a reminder, here is a bit of histology on the right and a schematic drawing here of a normal physis. Okay, and in this hypertrophic region here and here, we can see that the normal arrangement of the chondrocytes is in this columnar sort of arrangement and fashion. This study from early 2000s by Craig looked at, reported on the histology of these fractures in 13 cats. And I've highlighted the important findings from this study. So the lesion consists of irregular clusters of chondrocytes separated by an abundant matrix. The affected population in this study was 85% male and 90% overweight. So people get slipped capital femoral epiphyses as well, and the classic demographic are overweight teenage boys in America, particularly those of Afro-American descent. So there is some similarities here in what's happening. And here we have on the left from that study some images. This is an image on the left of an affected cat compared to a normal physis on the right here. And we can see that on the right, where we have this normal columnar arrangement, we have this much more haphazard arrangement of the chondrocyte clusters. So similar fractures occur in other species as well, although in piglets it tends to occur at a much younger age. In cats, I should say that we tend to see these fractures between about 8 months and 18 months. So you seem to get delayed closure of this physis, particularly in cats that are neutered early. So piglets get something similar, but it happens much younger, and it seems to be associated with a retained cartilaginous core that extends into the metaphysis. So that's not the same as we see in cats and people, where the entire physis is affected. In foals, they generally occur as a result of severe trauma, and sadly, in calves, the most common cause of these femoral capitis fractures are in cases of dystochia. Where the calf is exuberantly pulled on when they are presented hind limbs first. So what I really want to talk about is this, is the surgical management of these cases. There are three relatively small case series looking at femoral head and neck fractures in the cat. So before I show you the results of these studies, just have a little think to yourself about what you would advise owners in this case. You're presented with, say, an 18-month-old cat with this femoral head fracture. And I think that an awful lot of people, not everyone, but an awful lot of people would recommend femoral head and neck excision quite early on with these cases. But what's interesting, when you look at the results of these studies, we can see that across these three papers, there's actually a 100% success rate with fixation of these fractures. And the reason why there might be a discrepancy in how these fractures are perceived and what the perceived best action is in practice, and the fact that they actually can do very well with surgical fixation, might come from our understanding of blood supply and what we expect to happen. So back in the late 70s, early 80s, a chap called Rivera spent a bit of time reporting on the blood supply to the femoral head. All right, and these images taken from Tobias and Johnson Veterinary Surgery textbook summarize his findings. Okay, so we have the lateral and medial circumflex femoral arteries, okay, down here, A and B, and we have the caudal and cranial gluteal arteries at the top, C, and these, and then the iliolumbar vessels coming in. Let's move to the next slide. These anastomose to form this extracapsular ring at the base of the neck, okay. And then from that, the intracapsular vessels arise and they penetrate the joint capsule. An important thing to note here is that they're running up parallel to the femoral neck. Then the anastomose again near the physis and form an intracapsular ring, and the branches arise from that, penetrate the physis, and they form the interosseous arcuate blood supply to the epiphysis and the proximal femoral neck. So, like I say, Rivera did these studies in dogs and reported the results. So all the blood supply to the femoral head is coming from down here. Yeah, it's from distal back up proximal. What he also did, but never actually published, was describe the blood supply in cats. And it was pretty much exactly the same, except for one important difference. And that's that blood supply G here, coming in from blood vessels within the round ligament of the head of the femur, were much more developed in cats than they were in dogs. So what that means is, when you see these capitis fractures or these femoral head or neck fractures in dogs, the risk of long-term femoral head necrosis is very high, and you might be more inclined to go straight for a salvage option. But the risk of femoral head, particularly the articular surface, being affected by necrosis, by bone necrosis in cats, is much, much lower. So you have a much better chance of achieving union and having a good long-term function in cats. So if you're going to do these, it's actually a relatively straightforward fracture repair. The biggest challenge is aim. Because you're aiming for quite a small sort of area. And what you're going to be doing is placing two or three small diameter Kirschner wires or arthrodesis wires. So you're going to need decent retraction. It's always easier with an assistant, this surgery. You're going to need these K wires. You're going to need a drill or a wire driver. You can't really do this by hand. Trying to aim and drive these K wires with a hand chuck, it's pretty much impossible. So you need some sort of power. And you want a curved instrument, whether that's a periosteal elevator or a set of mosquito forceps. And you're using that to palpate the articular surface of the femoral head, feeling for the pins protruding. An aiming device may be useful. To be honest, in cats, I find them far too cumbersome. And you know, much better in my experience just to eyeball these. And this is what we're aiming for. We're aiming for a minimum of two pins because we need rotational stability to engage the femoral epiphysis. So the tips of the pins are sitting just below the cartilage. Okay, so on your postoperative radiographs, this is how you want it to look. There are loads of mechanical studies about whether you should use two pins or three pins, whether they should be placed in crossed fashion or parallel. My preference is two pins parallel. I think that gives you the best rotational stability and is also technically the easiest. I think the third pin is more likely to increase your risk of complications than it is to improve the stability. So that's my opinion. I think if you get two good pins, then you'll be fine. You really want to operate on these as soon as you can, but actually there were quite a few cases in these case series where they weren't operated on for several weeks and they still did well, as you saw, that 100% success rate. You do frequently get this apple coring of the femoral neck where the femoral neck looks narrow, so you get this lysis, but that is clinically irrelevant. It doesn't seem to affect the outcome in the cats. So your surgical approach, these can be done by a craniodorsal approach. Make sure that your joint capsule incision is parallel to the femoral neck. You're trying to preserve those intracapsular blood vessels, which are arising from that extracapsular ring further down the neck. I've already discussed the number and orientation of the pins and the size of pins. These tend to be under low load. So for your typical cat, as long as it's not some huge Norwegian forest cat or Maine Coon, etc. You know, generally a 0.9 mil pin will be sufficient. You might want to have a think about whether you place them retrograde, so drill them from the fracture surface out through the lateral cortex, reduce the fracture, and then drive them back across. Whether you want to place them normograde or whether you want to use an aiming device. My preference is always normograde without an aiming device. I think that, you know, you've got good visualization of the femoral neck. You can line yourself up quite nicely, reduce the fracture, drive the pin, and then check it with that curved instrument for joint penetration. That's my preference. Keep things as simple as possible. This is just a bit of long-term follow-up. We've got a bit of subluxation, a little bit of osteophytosis here. So radiographically, we've got union without any lysis. Like I say, a little bit of post-traumatic OA. Functionally, this cat was entirely normal. This, on the other hand, is Petra, who was a German Shepherd cross, who presented with a history of acute onset lameness some months ago that kind of got a little bit better, but then never fully resolved. And what we can see here is a misshapen sort of malunion of the femoral neck and sclerosis in the metaphysis here associated with this. So this was a slipped capitis fracture, a chronic one. And the dog was very lame and painful by the time it came in. Nothing to be done with that in terms of fixation. Your options are conservative management or salvage. She was a big dog, so we performed a total hip replacement in her. So, you know, I would like the take-home message there to be to seriously consider surgical stabilization of femoral capitis fractures in cats. I don't want you to get confused. And if you see them in dogs, the story is very much different. All right, so that brings us on to the stifle. Now, proportionately, we've spent, you know, sort of 35, 40 minutes there on the hip, and we're not going to spend anywhere near as much time on the stifle, and we're going to spend a lot less time on the tarsus. And the reason for that is, you know, I think that the conditions that we've covered are important ones. All right, let's have a look at the stifle then, and we're going to start by looking at fractures of the patella. We see three approximately, that there are more, but roughly speaking, you know, generally that the most common patella fractures we see fit into one of these three camps. We see some traumatic fractures. We see atraumatic fractures in certain cats, which we're going to spend a bit of time talking about. And we see some patellar fractures after other stifle surgery that might change the mechanics of the knee. So these are reported post-TPLO in dogs. They're generally managed conservatively. They are more of a patellar tendonitis kind of pathology that affects the patella, as opposed to being a true articular fracture. So we're not going to discuss those at all. A similar thing can be seen after total knee replacement in dogs and people. We're also not going to spend too much time on traumatic fractures, except I am going to look at treatment options and surgery options. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about patellar fractures in cats. So probably the most common cause of patellar fractures in cats is this condition that has more recently been given the name patellar and dental anomaly syndrome, or PADS. It was previously known colloquially as knees and teeth syndrome, or CATS. And I've got an example of a case that we saw here a couple of months ago. We can see that this cat had an obvious fracture of its left patella. But when we look at the right patella, it's a slightly unusual shape. You know, it's slightly elongated. It's got this curve to it. You could potentially, thank you for the marker there. You could potentially envisage that this is a healed old patella fracture. And whether it's related or not, we've got this little enthesiophyte here at the insertion of the patella tendon. So, a lot of cats, so it was recognized around about 10 years or so ago, and Sorrell Langley Hobbs has sort of led the charge, if you like, on this condition, that we see these cats with patellar fractures, and they often have other fractures in other bones. At the time, it was particularly the proximal tibia that was identified. And then through surveying cases, or surveying vets that dealt with cases, they identified that a lot of these cats also had retained deciduous teeth. And that's where these acronyms came from. In a much more recent paper, late last year, in JFMS, Sorrell's group at Bristol, or primarily from Bristol University, Langford vets, presented this case series in JFMS, describing the incidence and types of preceding and subsequent fractures in cats with PADS. And these are some of the images from that paper. So we've already mentioned these proximal tibial fractures. They also saw humeral condylar fractures, fractures of the calcaneus, fractures of the pelvis, fractures of many different bones, not all of which are illustrated here. And we don't yet know what underlies this condition. An original or a sort of an earlier kind of hypothesis was that it might be a form of osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a group of diseases, if you like, that affects the development of type 1 collagen and therefore the strength of bones. That's not proven or disproven, but it's sort of probably not a favored hypothesis at the moment. The thing that a lot of these fractures have in common is that they occur in places where you might expect stress fractures to occur. And just to spend a bit of time on this, you know, stress fractures are subdivided into fatigue fractures, which is essentially normal bone that is subjected to repetitive abnormal loads. So that's what we see in athletes and military personnel, etc. And then the other type of stress fracture are insufficiency fractures, which is where the bones are being subjected to normal loads, but biologically they are not able to deal with them or adapt to them. So this is what we see, you know, in older people with osteoporosis, for example. And there is a feeling that perhaps what we're seeing in these cats with PADS are numerous insufficiency fractures as a form of stress fracture. This is a case that we saw here last year. So these are axial slices of an MRI scan. So T2 weighted scan, T1 weighted scan over here on the right. And this is the atlas. So we can see the transverse processes of the atlas. And we can see the dorsal arch here. With this fracture in the dorsal arch and increased T2 weighted chord intensity below it here. So what we had in this cat was a depressed dorsal lamina fracture in the atlas, and it was only on going back and questioning the owner that we discovered that this cat had had multiple episodes of lameness throughout its life. And when radiographs were collected at its referring veterinary surgeon, there were a number of old fractures affecting the pelvis and other bones that were identified. So this is really a case of raising awareness, and that if you see a patella fracture in a cat, probably the first thing to cross your mind is this condition before you start talking about whether you fix it or not. So, moving on to the treatment of patella fractures in PADS cases and other cases, your options are to consider conservative management or to stabilize the fracture in some way. Now, obviously, the main force acting upon these fractures, particularly if it's a transverse fracture of the patella, is a distractive force of the quadriceps mechanism. So it's that quadriceps force that we're trying to resist. So this is very different to lots of other types of fracture, where we are, whereas tension, distractive forces are generally the least of our worries, if we're dealing with a long bone fracture, for example. So one option is conservative management, and sometimes the fibrous tissue in the region offers enough support that with careful conservative management, you can get a good clinical outcome with conservative management, even though this is an articular fracture. But you can get these cats, even these cats with these underlying conditions, you probably can get these patellas to heal. And this paper reports healing in two cases of kittens with patella fractures, where they were managed with a fairly simple cerclage wire, sort of in the periosteum, if you like, around the patella. And this would be my preferred technique for the vast majority of patella fractures. This paper looked mechanically, so it's an ex vivo paper, looking at the feasibility and strength of plating patella fractures with a custom plate. This really isn't a practical application at the moment. The problem being here that this is a high-profile implant in a region where you have no soft tissue cover, really. You're straight onto skin. And the skin, furthermore, is under a fair bit of tension. So this isn't really a practical application. I show this slide because it illustrates this other technique for stabilizing patella fractures, whereby a K wire or similar is placed in a distal, proximal to distal direction, and a figure of eight wire is placed over the top. This is technically a very, very challenging thing to do in the live animal without causing further damage, which is why, as I say, that simpler cerclage wire is generally my preferred technique. So that's us done on patella fractures. Femoral condylar fractures are not common, but they're common enough that you will almost certainly see one if you're doing a fair amount of orthopedics. You'll see one sooner or later, and they are a particular surgical challenge. They can be quite good fun, but not to be undertaken lightly. And in terms of classification systems, it is quite useful in terms of communicating with other clinicians and also getting your thoughts in order about what the prognosis might be. Again, coming back to that issue, not just of making a decision about what you're going to do, but how you're going to manage your owner's expectations. So this classification system was proposed by Unger and others in the early 90s in this VCOT paper. It's based on a human classification system. The two numbers at the beginning of this classification refer to the bone. So humerus is 1, radius ulnar is 2, femur is 3, tibia is 4. The second number pertains to which area of the bone. So one is the proximal metaphysis, two is diaphysis, and three is distal metaphysis. So by definition already, a femoral condylar is always going to be a 3-3. And then they are further subdivided into types A, B, and C. A don't involve the articular surface at all. Type B fractures involve one condyle. Okay, there's just the one fracture, and the fractures might be in the sagittal plane, as they are with B1 and B2 type, or in the frontal plane, as illustrated in this B3 type. And things get really tricky and really challenging when we're into the type C fractures. So a type C fracture involves both condyles with two simple fracture lines. Type C2 is comminuted in the supracondylar region, but the articular fracture itself is simple. And type C3, the ones that carry the worst prognosis, are comminuted at the articular surface. Now, these are very often associated with soft tissue injuries of the collateral ligaments and of the cruciate ligaments, in particular the caudal cruciate ligament. And this group here reported on a small case series of dogs with bicondylar femoral fractures with concurrent ligament or tendon injuries. And actually, the outcomes didn't vary too much. Whether or not those ligament injuries were addressed primarily, but obviously it does depend on what the ligament that's injured is. It is absolutely normal for these fractures on the post-op rads to end up looking something like this. Okay, you have to be fairly imaginative in how you get these things stabilized, and very often these pins might need to go through the articular surface and be countersunk. There is always that risk of migration. This image over here on the right here is a follow-up image from the fracture, this fracture. So we see this is a very comminuted, very nasty fracture. Sorry, let me pull that cursor in. A very comminuted, very nasty fracture that has been reconstructed pretty well, but certainly not perfectly. And this is what that looked like at implant removal a few months later. So although they're very challenging and, in theory, you are not getting very often anatomic alignment, the clinical outcome can be pretty good with these. I suppose that the other part of your decision-making process here is, well, what are your options? Because you don't have too many with these femoral condylar fractures. There is no excision arthroplasty suitable for the knee. Stifle arthrodesis is a very unpredictable thing to do. It can be useful in very select cases, but it's nothing like a carpal or tarsal arthrodesis where you'd expect a really good level of function. You will be expecting a very, very compromised level of limb function with a stifle arthrodesis. So really, your only salvage option here is a total knee replacement. And commercially available total knee replacements won't be could not be used in a situation like this. There is one reported case in the literature by Bill Lisca, where he took the biometrics commercially available TKR system and had a custom block made to essentially fill the void. That was left in the condyle, the femoral condyle of this dog. So this is a custom total knee replacement being used to manage, a very severe type C3 lesion of the femoral condyle. So it's possible, but not a regular occurrence by any means. Don't have much on tibial plateau fractures at all. Most of the tibial plateau fractures that you'll see will be type A. Yeah, they won't involve the joint surface. Very occasionally, you might see these articular surface fractures, though, and they can be very, very challenging to diagnose. The lameness is often not as severe as you would expect, and they can be very difficult to see on a radiograph. So this is another case report from Neil Burton from a few years ago when he was back at Bristol. And this was a case that had a chronic lameness that had been managed conservatively and was presented to them, and they diagnosed this type B3 tibial plateau fracture, this sort of non-union. And difficult to convince yourself, even once you know it's there on the radiograph, but the intraoperative view is much more convincing. We can see this fracture line there across the tibial plateau, but certainly very forgivable to miss these fractures on radiographs. They can be very challenging to diagnose, but a condition that is worth being aware of. And in that case, they use the total knee replacement to manage that. Okay, so we've been going about 55 minutes an hour now, so this is going to run a little bit over the hour. But I'm not going to spend too long talking about the tarsus. We're going to spend a bit of time talking about malleoli fractures. These are probably the most common form of tarsal fracture that you're going to see. And then we will just have a very brief discussion around some of the other fractures that can occur. So malleolar fractures are generally avulsion injuries due to hyperextension or valgus or varus stress of the tarsus, and obviously also seen relatively frequently in shearing injuries. And the main issue that these cause is not with incongruity or issues at the articulating surface, although these are, in principle at least, articulating surfaces. The main issue with these, as you're well aware, I'm sure, is the effect that it has on the collateral stability of the tarsus. And they are generally repaired when they are big enough with pins and tension band wire, as you can see in these images here, taken from Simon Roach's case series published in Vet Record a few years back. And we will often coapt these injuries either with an external coaptation bandage or splint, or with a transarticular external fixator. So nothing new there really in how we manage these, and you know, I'm sure you're well versed in stress view radiography and that kind of thing. But again, I think one thing I'd like to focus on here is how we manage our owners' expectations with these cases, because from a technical point of view, these are relatively straightforward fracture repairs. We are looking at a pin and tension band apparatus, which most of us doing a significant amount of orthopedics are quite comfortable with. But there is a fairly significant complication rate with these fractures. So Simon's paper was looking at cats in particular, and we were looking at around about a 30% plus complication rate, which varied anything from KY migration to persistent instability. At least one of the cats in this case series ended with limb amputation. So although the prognosis is generally good, as you can see at the bottom, 17 out of 21 cats for which they had long-term follow-up, the owners were satisfied. The owners need to be prepared for the long haul with these cases, I believe, because, like I say, I think that the complications are not at all uncommon. Moving on from malleolar fractures, this is a case that we saw here about 3 years ago. It was Scooby, who presented with a chronic low-grade lameness that had been going on for about 6 months that was exacerbated by exercise. And this dog was doing a lot of exercise. And what we identified on a CT scan here was this fracture of the lateral talar ridge of the right tarsus. We compare that to the same region over here on the left tarsus. Okay, this is what it should look like, and we've got this fracture here. Now, there are a couple of these cases in the literature. There was this one is the most recent one that was reported a few years ago, and these authors actually reported the surgical stabilization of this ridge. Scooby, we managed conservatively. This was a chronic injury. It was minimally displaced, and the lameness was really very mild, and his activity levels were very good. So we managed Scooby conservatively. But in this case, they reported a fibular malleolar osteotomy to get access. So it's a good example of how difficult the access to articular fractures can be. And they lag screwed it. And they got a good result in this case. But some controversy does exist around the etiology of these fractures. And some people believe that it is most likely to be a consequence of a form of osteochondritis dissecans lesion. So whether surgical stabilization of these fragments should be uniformly adopted is a controversial point. But again, a diagnosis that's worth being aware of. The other thing that this case report demonstrated, actually, if I go back a bit, is, again, coming back to one of these principles of articular fracture decision-making, is that identifying them and making decisions based on two-dimensional imaging like radiography is very, very challenging. And it really took this oblique, flexed tarsus, skyline view to convincingly identify the fragment in this reported case. Nearly there, just a couple more things to discuss. And again, once we get down into the intertarsal bones, if you like, these are, strictly speaking, articular fractures, but these joints are very, very low motion. So really, from a decision-making point of view and from a mechanical point of view, we're really considering, bear with me, we're really considering the tarsus and the intertarsal bones and intertarsal joints really as a load-bearing column, much more so than we are, you know, a highly functioning joint. So in our decision-making process, these actually have more in common with a long bone fracture than they do with your classic articular. Things that we see are central tarsal bone fractures, and there is a typing system for these, which essentially is a measure of how severely comminuted they are. These are typically seen in sighthounds, you know, particularly the right tarsus of greyhounds, but either tarsus of many lurchers and things like that. And they can be reconstructed, as in the case on the left. They can be reconstructed like this, and if so, then that can carry with it a very good prognosis. But very often, they are severely comminuted like this, and really the best option for cases like that is a partial tarsal arthrodesis, just aiming to reestablish that load-bearing column of bone there. I don't have the paper specifically referenced or on the slides here, but there was a good paper by Hercock from the University of Liverpool, probably around about 10 or 12 years ago, perhaps, that compared radiography with CT for diagnosing and classifying central tarsal bone fractures. And as you would probably expect, radiography was really quite poor at detecting the level of comminution. It would very, very frequently underestimate just how comminuted the central tarsal bone was, and could give you false hope for a reconstructing strategy. So something just to be aware of there. So this is an example of a comminuted case where the main body of the central tarsal bone has been pulled back in with this lag screw. And that's really just to try and establish the load bearing down the medial aspect of the tarsus, just so that the bony column is load sharing with the plate. But the main goal here is a partial tarsal arthrodesis, or this tarsometatarsal arthrodesis, to restore good function. And, you know, there is an arthrodesis webinar available in this orthopedic club, which I did a good 3-4 years ago, that covers partial tarsal arthrodesis in more detail. Carries with it an excellent prognosis for really, really good limb function, with the caveat that there is a fairly significant complication rate to be aware of. sometimes see these calcaneal fractures. These sometimes occur in combination with central tarsal bone fractures, and they're usually high trauma injury. The calcaneus is a very hard, very brittle piece of bone, so it's not unusual for these fractures to be highly comminuted as they were in this case. We did manage to stabilize this and get this arthrodesed, but a challenging case for sure. Okay, so that wraps up this seminar, this webinar on articular fractures of the pelvic limb. Clearly, it's not comprehensive. I don't think we could cover every fracture type in a huge amount of depth, but hopefully I've highlighted some interesting issues, and I'll take any questions. We have a question here in our question screen. I can't actually read it all. The question is, do PADS fractures heal as well as normal fractures? And did you say it was associated with retained deciduous teeth? So the second part of that question, the answer is yes, that's right. An awful lot of the cats that present with these fractures, on further questioning of the owner, they might have had retained deciduous teeth, so that just gives you a clue that they might have this condition. I'm not sure if there's any sort of good data to say if there is a significant difference in prognosis between fracture healing in PADS cats and non-PADS cats, but my impression has been that yeah, they heal. They generally do heal well. The caveat with that is that if you have a stress fracture that has some of those chronic changes like sclerosis at the fracture site, then I think that those cases would carry with them a poorer prognosis. But I think that the bone healing process itself is not particularly affected by this underlying condition. It's the ultimate strength of the bone that is the issue. So I think that they generally do heal as a rule of thumb, but I would just bear in mind the caveat to assess every fracture individually, and if there are some of these changes, and I'm thinking particularly here about some of those proximal tibia fractures. Sometimes see those, and there is a fair bit of sclerosis, which means that obviously you've got an impaired blood flow there, and you might just give a slightly more guarded prognosis in that case. Okay, so I don't see any other questions coming through. So I'd like to thank you again for joining me in the webinar. It's very much appreciated your attendance, and I'd like to thank CPD Solutions as well for inviting me to give another webinar. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Ben for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.